From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Bernie Sanders says he will stay in the presidential race to compete in the Washington, D.C. primary next Tuesday. That statement after Sanders met today at the White House with President Obama. And he spoke to the media after the meeting.
I am going to do everything in my power, and I will work as hard as I can to make sure that Donald Trump does not become president of the United States.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, he's not dropping out of the race. He's not endorsing Hillary Clinton, at least not yet. But it did seem like a bit of a different tone from Sanders today.
Yes, there was more of a subdued tone in Sanders' discussion of what he had said to the president and what he intended to do. We should also say that he has vowed on a number of occasions to work as hard as he can to make sure that Donald Trump never became president, and that saying, of course, that Donald Trump could never be president and things of that nature. So we have heard that before. What we heard, if you will, between the lines today, and he went on to basically repeat many of the key elements of his usual stump speech,
right,
plus committing to being for statehood for the District of Columbia, which of course votes next Tuesday, and that's a good incentive to a D.C. voter to want to vote for Bernie Sanders. But in addition to that, he also indicated that he would be going forward to the convention and he wanted to bring certain issues forward, but there was a little bit of give in that, a little bit of non-defiance, if you will.
Well, and I also looked up, because I noticed that he said he was for D.C. statehood as well. It is something that he has said in the past. And by the way, Hillary Clinton has also said that she's in favor of D.C. statehood as well. So I guess no matter who wins on the Democratic side in the D.C. primary, they've got somebody who's going to push for statehood, whether they're successful in that or not. But he also did speak about working together with Hillary Clinton. Here he is.
I spoke briefly to Secretary Clinton on Tuesday night, and I congratulated her on her very strong campaign. I look forward to meeting with her in the near future to see how we can work together to defeat Donald Trump and to create a government which represents all of us and not just the 1%.
Is that a signal to you, Ron, that he's soon to endorse Hillary Clinton, maybe after the D.C. primary?
I think we put a little too much weight on this word endorse.
Mm.
As we've seen on the Republican side, it's possible for people to support Donald Trump without coming right out and endorsing him. They say that they will vote for him. So there may be some wiggle room in this for Bernie Sanders and his supporters as well. Work together, most people would read that as being a kind of endorsement. But at the same time, he might not come right out and endorse her right away. He could do that right after the D.C. primary next Tuesday. That's the last time he's committed to actually running against her. But then he could also not endorse her right after that particular primary and sort of leave that open for the convention itself, when we'll find out just how much of a disruptive element he plans to be at that convention in Philadelphia in July.
What about President Obama? We haven't heard from him yet. Is he going to come out and endorse Hillary Clinton today?
We expect President Obama to endorse Hillary Clinton. We've expected that since it was clear that she was going to have a majority of the pledged delegates. Now, I'm not talking about superdelegates here. I'm talking about people who have been allocated by primaries or caucuses, pledged delegates. Since it's been clear she would have that majority, it's been clear that President Obama would add his endorsement to that once the regular primaries were over, with the exception perhaps of D.C. So that would have been possible as early as yesterday, but the president maybe put it off because he was going to be meeting with Bernie Sanders today, and it seemed like a courtesy to leave it open. But now that that meeting has been held, and now that that meeting is in the books, it could come at any time, Jeremy.
Bernie Sanders also spoke at length about Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Let's listen.
It is unbelievable to me, and I say this in all sincerity, that the Republican Party would have a candidate for president who in the year 2016 makes bigotry and discrimination the cornerstone of his campaign. In my view, the American people will not vote for or tolerate a candidate who insults Mexicans and Latinos, who insults Muslims, who insults African Americans and women.
Ron, you and I were just in California for the primary there, and I spoke with some Bernie Sanders supporters who said, you know, even if he can't be the nominee, I want him to stay in as long as possible so he can really keep fighting for this message that he's been talking about all along and make it something that Hillary Clinton has to talk about at the convention.
Yes, and that is what he wants to do and what we expect him to do and what his followers want him to do. And that's the most important thing at this point, not just Bernie Sanders' endorsement, but the votes of his followers. That's what Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama want more than anything else.
NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, the Supreme Court handed down several decisions today, though not the three most prominent cases still pending, all out of Texas. We're waiting for those decisions on abortion, affirmative action, and immigration. But what did the court do today? Dahlia Lithwick is there. She covers the Supreme Court for Slate and ducked into an office to speak to us by Skype. Dahlia, one of today's opinions has to do with whether a person can be prosecuted for the same crime by both the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico and the mainland U.S. What did the court say?
This was just a basic question about, for purposes of double jeopardy, the idea that you can't be prosecuted twice for the same crime, whether Puerto Rico is a sovereign. Mm-hmm. And Puerto Rico was claiming, we are a sovereign and we can prosecute these gun dealers, even though the federal government already has a plea bargain in a separate trial. And the Supreme Court resoundingly said, by a 6-2 margin, nope. Puerto Rico, you are not a sovereign for purposes of double jeopardy. And Elena Kagan wrote the opinion in which she more or less said, look, the ultimate source of Puerto Rico's power as Puerto Rico is the U.S. government. And so, no, it's not a sovereign. And needless to say, Sonia Sotomayor, who is of Puerto Rican descent, she and Stephen Breyer were the two dissenters.
Well, and this is only going to add, I'm imagining, to Puerto Rico's call to please let us be sovereign and be a state.
That's exactly right. And Justice Breyer in dissent makes that very point.
Yeah. Well, the court also ruled today that a Pennsylvania Supreme Court judge should have recused himself from the case of a death row inmate that he had once prosecuted as a district attorney. Tell us more about this.
Right. This is a case called Williams versus Pennsylvania. And isn't it funny, Robin, that we're having a big case about judicial bias and judicial mm-hmm. recusal in the very week that Donald Trump has made this kind of a federal case? In this particular case, we have an appeal from a death row prisoner who was literally committed his crime in 1984. And all these years later, what he's saying is, hey, one of the judges on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who wouldn't set aside my death penalty served as the head of the prosecutor's office back when my case was tried, and he should have recused himself when he sat on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And by a 5-3 margin, with Justice Anthony Kennedy lining up with the court's liberal wing, the court agreed with him. They set aside his death penalty and said, you know what, that this judge in Pennsylvania needed to step aside because he did have a dog in this fight. And as Justice Kennedy says, you can't fairly be a judge in your own case, and deciding to seek the death penalty is a significant prosecutorial action, which means you cannot be objective at trial.
Well, and that last part is what might differentiate it from people who just don't like the way a judge is ruling because his parents might be Mexican. I'm bringing it back to Donald Trump. I mean, what do you think the wider implications are? It seems very clear in this Supreme Court decision that it was a very clear conflict of interest.
I think your point is exactly right, Robin, that when you try to get a judge to step aside, you have to show that there's an actual conflict of interest. And the idea that you don't like the heritage of a judge who's hearing a case that actually has nothing to do with race can't possibly rise to the level of a conflict of interest. And that when you say, hey, I just think this judge is going to hate me because of things I said that might make his parents mad, that's just not in the realm of meaningful conflict, meaningful bias.
Okay. So the three biggies that we're waiting for, there's a challenge to President Obama's executive action on immigration. There's also the Texas abortion case, which is being described by many as possibly the most important abortion case in 25 years. Just take a second there. Remind us what's at stake there.
In the Texas case, I mean, I think it's fair to say it certainly would have been the most important case since 1992, except, of course, now the court is down a man. And so all of the cases that are pending that would have been blockbusters have the potential to be 4-4 ties. The two issues in the case have to do with, one, rejiggering abortion facilities as ambulatory surgical centers so that they, even though they're not providing surgical abortions, are set up as surgical entities, and requiring doctors to have admitting privileges in local hospitals. And the takeaway is that since that law was passed, we know that in Texas we went from 40 clinics to 19 clinics. And if the law is allowed to stand, there would be 10 clinics left to serve all of Texas. So the stakes are extremely high. And certainly I think it's fair to say that unless this comes down as a 4-4 tie, it will be consequential not just in Texas, but in every single state around the country in terms of giving guidance on how much abortion can be regulated.
Yeah. And then there's the affirmative action case, Fisher v. University of Texas. Back before the court for a second time, the case of Abigail Fisher, the white student who challenged UT's consideration of race as a factor in the admissions process when she was denied admission. One of the major cases still ahead. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate and stepped out today to talk to us about today's decisions. Dahlia, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
About 14,000 people were expected to attend the Muslim prayer service today in Louisville, Kentucky for Muhammad Ali. He'll be buried tomorrow after a public service he's been planning for years. He wanted to be buried in his hometown, where he learned to box after someone stole his bike. We've been remembering Ali all week. Today, Ali the boxer. Jake Ryan from Here Now contributor WFPL starts with young fighters in Louisville.
Walk into the TKO boxing gym and the first thing that hits you is the humidity, then the smell of sweat. The gym is in a renovated auto garage about 4 miles from Muhammad Ali's boyhood home. Its regulation boxing ring sits beneath big skylight windows, and about 24 people are jumping rope and throwing jabs on heavy hanging bags. Braxton Carter comes here as often as he can.
I've been boxing about 4 years, regional golden gloves, been to nationals a couple times, runner up in a couple national tournaments, looking to turn pro next year.
Carter is 30. He was one of the gym's first members when it opened about a year ago, about the same time he got a big tattoo of two big boxing gloves on his back.
The tattoo was still healing when we was painting the walls.
Above the gloves is written, "Home of the Greatest."
It's the best tattoo I ever got.
The greatest is Muhammad Ali, boxer, civil rights activist, and Louisville native. It's tough to not notice Ali's influence here at the gym. For one, there's a 20-foot mural of him on the gym's outside wall. And the boxers, from 12-year-old Jordan Nunnally to 71-year-old Lewis Johnson, all have something to say about Ali.
He was a great fighter.
But nobody ever thought that he'd grow up be world's heavyweight champion.
Johnson grew up boxing in the same gym as Ali, a few blocks from where this gym sits today. In the ring, he remembers Ali for his unorthodox style.
He would turn sideways, and that would give him more of a reach. And he would, like a basketball player, use that pivot foot, in and out. Bip, bip, in and out. He liked the whole range.
That style won Ali 56 professional boxing matches with 37 knockouts over 21 years.
His legacy as a boxer is great, but it's not so much his boxing legacy that got him where he is. It's what he done outside the ring.
While boxers here aspire to be champions just like Ali, many also look at his conviction and global humanitarian legacy as something to emulate.
You know, I've been brought up on Muhammad Ali.
19-year-old Terrell Hargrove says he's seen all the videos of Ali's fights. But it's not the knockouts that stand out for him. It's Ali's dedication to stand up for what he believes that's had the biggest influence on Hargrove.
I think he was heard meant for, you know, a bigger reason other than just boxing. To be a good human being to other people.
That idea of being a good person is as important at this gym as learning to move your feet in the ring and keep your hands up.
Hey, touch off your chin, touch off your chin.
James Dixon is the head coach at TKO.
Every kid's not, again, going to be a gold medalist or world champ, but what we can instill work ethic, values, principles, show up on time if you can, phone call, pull up your pants. There's things here that we teach that are more invaluable than boxing.
Dixon says when kids sign up at the gym, he tells each they can be a world champ just like Ali if they work hard. He also shows them the mural of Ali and asks for something more.
When they see Ali, I tell them to dig deeper than the ring. Go look at his work outside the ring. Look at what he did. Look what he stood for.
Let's go back to Braxton Carter with the back tattoo. He says boxing was just a small slice of Ali's life.
It's a million things about Ali that made him great that didn't even involve even putting on a pair of gloves.
It's that other side of Ali, out of the ring, that will carry on his legacy even here in a sweaty boxing gym on the south side of downtown Louisville, the home of the champ. For Here and Now, I'm Jake Ryan.
So Ali's life lessons live on, but what about boxing? Sports writing giant Robert Lipsight was 26 when the New York Times assigned him to cover the 1964 Sonny Liston Cassius Clay match. Bob, how did the fight crowd first view Ali?
Well, it's so interesting that, you know, we talk about him as the most controversial and polarizing character in sports. And that was obviously for political and social and religious reasons. But he was already polarizing for his boxing style itself. The traditionalists were absolutely appalled at the way he fought. First of all, he leaned back from punches. You never do that. You're supposed to go from side to side, called bobbing and weaving, in which the punches go over your shoulder. So immediately it was assumed that he would, you know, lean too far back, somebody would take another step and knock him out. Immediately, he allowed himself to be cornered in the ropes. But the point was that he was so much faster than any heavyweight anybody had ever seen before, that he was able to break all these rules. He was able to dance away. He was able to keep circling left against, you know, people's powerful left hooks. And as it turned out, of course, he was Mozart. He was idiosyncratic. And certainly in those early years, he could stylistically do anything he wanted simply because his hand speed and his foot speed were just so fast.
You know, I was thinking, I was trying to explain to a young man the Ali shuffle, and I tried it and I almost hurt myself. You know, it's the shuffling, the scissoring the legs back and forth.
Well, maybe instead of thinking of that, you should think of Michael Jackson's moonwalk. They're pretty much the same thing. He would do the shuffle, you would see the other boxer would kind of stiffen, what's going on here, and then bam, Ali would hit him in the face. So the Ali shuffle was kind of you know, a wonderful confection. I'm not sure it was exactly a tactic of more than distraction.
Yeah. He'd float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. His trainer came up with that. But you mentioned, you know, being back against the ropes, the rope-a-dope. I mean, this was a technique when he got older. He'd just stand there and take the punches?
Well, it was done most effectively against George Foreman, an incredibly powerful puncher and someone who was, you know, supposed to pulverize him. The point was that Ali, who had been out of action for 3.5 years, now he's, you know, he's back and he's much older. That marvelous foot speed we talked about is gone. His hands are not so fast. So what can he do against a younger, bigger, far more powerful boxer? Well, what he could do was take away the guy's strength by sacrificing his own body. So what he did in the rope-a-dope was leaning back against the ropes and letting the other fighter bang away on his shoulders and arms, and unfortunately sometimes his face. But after 7 or 8 rounds, Foreman was punched out. He had nothing left, and Ali still had enough left to knock him out.
How did sports writers, I mean, you were one of the younger sports writers, but there were some who'd been in the fight arena for a while. Here comes this guy, part of his game was his lip, the Louisville lip. This is no jive. Cooper will go in five, you know. Talk about how sports writers felt about him.
Well, most of the sports writers were dismissive of him. The only reason I got to cover the fight was because the New York Times regular boxing writer didn't think it was worth his time to go all the way to Miami Beach for a one-round knockout. So, you know, send the kid from Night Rewrite. He doesn't have much to do. So that was me. The older boxing writers, they were appalled, as we said, by his style, the way that he was kind of so breezy and dismissive of them. And also there was a great racialism involved.
Right.
Here was a young black man who was kind of disrespectful in a kind of a friendly way of all these old white men who were much more comfortable, you know, with these, quote, grateful Negroes, Joe Louis, Sonny Liston, who just seemed happy to be there and were respectful and gave, you know, simple interviews and laconic answers. So it was marvelous. And I just remember in the week leading up to that fight, all I could think was, oh, I hope he doesn't get hurt too badly because I'd love to cover him again sometime. I didn't realize it was the beginning of 52 years of coverage.
Right. Is boxing over with his death? I mean, it's declined.
Well, boxing is over. Yeah, boxing is always over. Boxing only comes back when some sort of transcendent figure emerges, somebody who is, you know, so exciting or powerful or captures the zeitgeist or touches us. There hasn't been anybody like that since Muhammad Ali, you know, a fearsome person like Mike Tyson, but nobody who really touches our heart. And people are also beginning to understand there's no socially acceptable reason for boxing to exist. Why should two people, you know, go into an enclosed space and try to give each other brain trauma? Mm. The other point of view is that this has always been the realm of minorities. You know, people who did not have money from dad, their only equity was their bodies. Their flesh and blood. And that's what they gave up. That's what they gave up in the ring, in sport, in so many jobs in America that no longer exist. But certainly, boxing was one of the main ways that you kind of gave your flesh and blood to make money.
Yeah, and make a name. Robert Lidsite, sports writer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, the greatest relationship in sports broadcasting was between Ali and Howard Cosell. We highly recommend David Kindren's book, Sound and Fury. Tomorrow, two American poets on Ali the Poet. Send us your favorite poetic quotes. I will do to Buster what the Indians did to Custer. Leave them with this story at hereandnow.org.
And a lot of working couples should be able to relate to this next story. The Harvard Business Review found that it's not uncommon for people to argue with their spouses and partners in the first 15 minutes after getting home from work. Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins me here in the studio. Hi, Kurt.
Glad to be here.
So some people are going to be saying, well, not a big surprise. That happens to me all the time. Others would think you'd be happy to be relaxed and at home after a day at work.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the days of leaving work carefree when the factory whistle blows are over. Today's jobs are more dynamic. We are more likely to bring it home. Technology helps with that, right? And often we're still kind of processing these knowledge interactions that we go through every day at work. And so it carries over. And it can very easily, if you don't manage that transition home the best, that can very easily, you know, those first 15 minutes can cloud the rest of the evening together.
So it's about bringing your work home with you. It's about continuing to work after you get home?
It's about continuing or processing or figuring out what you need. Different people really have different reactions to work. And unfortunately, you know, we kind of have this assumption that, you know, my spouse is just going to let me be myself. And so we spend all day at work, you know, managing our relationships with our coworkers and managers and clients. And then we throw all those skills out the window when we get home because, you know, I don't have to actually manage this most important stakeholder in my life.
There has been research into how quickly people recover from bad experiences, something like a bad day at work, perhaps. What does that tell us?
Well, you're right. There's a lot of understanding of people's different emotional and psychological needs. There's a growing body of research into resilience or recovery. But basically, when you look at brain activity of people who are getting over an interaction, different people have different brain activity and basically have different responses.
So if you're a person who takes longer to recover from a bad day, are you more prone to fight with your partner when you get home?
Not necessarily. It depends on how you deal with it. You know, somebody who didn't have had a terrible day may be the sort of person who actually puts that away when they get home. Somebody who had just an average day can still want to kind of talk it through. And that's why it's really important to talk these issues out and understand the different needs of your spouse and yourself.
So what are you supposed to do, though? If you're listening to this and you're saying, I do that, I get in fights after I get home from work, I'm stressed out, I take my work home with me, What do you do to avoid getting in arguments with the person that you love?
Yeah, well, a good rule of thumb is not to talk about work when you during those first 15 minutes.
Just wait a little longer.
Just wait a little bit longer. This happens to me. Like, I will walk home. I'll look at my phone on the way in the door. I'll see an email with feedback, and I'll immediately start talking to my wife about it. And she'll say, where's my kiss? Right? So first of all, you definitely do need to talk with your spouse or partner about your different emotional needs, your different expectations, what you want to be able to do, to talk, how you want to talk through work. But a good rule of thumb is don't do that in those first 15 minutes. Get your evening or rest of the day started off right.
Another thing I was thinking about the other day as my phone was buzzing with text messages coming through is, why does everyone have the right to interrupt me at any time? I should turn off the vibrate on the text messages. I'll check it when I want to. You don't have the right to interrupt my day.
That's you managing your own interactions.
And I clearly don't have the strength to do it because I still haven't. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. And we've got the story at our website, hereandnow.org. Kurt, thank you.
You got it.
Even if you've never heard of Adir Abergel, chances are you've seen his work. It walks down the red carpet, adorns magazine covers, flashes across the television screen, crowning the heads of stars. Israeli-Moroccan and now a resident of Los Angeles, Adir is the it man of hair, an artist who smashes molds, can throw out the blow dryer and use bobby pins. Did you know you should put the ripple side down to prevent slippage? To build wild sculptures. He's also a high-wire act who changed Anne Hathaway's hair 8 times in under 2 minutes per do when she co-hosted the Oscars. And to his clients, who include Jennifer Garner, Kristen Stewart, Rooney Mara, he is a therapist. We're going to have pictures of his work at hereandnow.org, including the magic we're sure he'll work on our colleagues. Adir Abergel, welcome.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, everybody's so self-conscious. They're kind of walking around like feeling their hair. But first of all, just give me the sort of the overarching thought here. What is so important about hair?
Hair can truly define who you are as a person. And it's also such a beautiful accessory. It really can make you into an individual. You can play with the looks, with the colors, with the shapes, with the textures. Hair can really bring a personality to an individual.
I love that accessory. It's a necklace for your head. Well, and we're going to have tons
for your life.
For your life.
For your life.
And as you know, for many women in particular, it is also a lifelong battle.
Correct.
To find the hair that they think mirrors who they are. You say it is who you are, but many people feel disconnected from their hair.
Yes.
We're going to have pictures of a lot of your work. The Met Gala recently, you had Kristen Stewart with that sort of, I don't know, what would you say, grunge look?
Yeah, so that was kind of, I was really thinking about like early 90s Nirvana grunge, not even applying heat, but really using products that could really bring out that natural texture and that little bit of grunge within her.
Her hair is shorter, so it just reaches below her ears.
Yeah.
But on the top, there's just pieces pulled up and there's wisps everywhere. And, you know, this sort of upsweep look that was messy started a few years ago.
Yeah.
But if you don't pull this off, and again, pictures at hereandnow.org, it just looks messy.
It does, but I think it's the entire complete look. So you have to look at hair truly as an accessory, but it's also a part of an entire story. Your makeup and your clothing and all of that can really be a part of this great story that you're trying to tell.
I'm looking at Rooney Mara from the Oscars. Hair sleeked beautifully back and then just it looks like a braid coming down the back of her head.
Rooney really loves to wear her hair very sleek and off her face. And so I'm always trying to reimagine different shapes with having your hair pulled back.
Wait, you mean you can't just stick your hair up in a little thing at the back of your head with a CVS clip?
I mean, you can.
I don't know anyone who does that.
You can. I mean, I don't know anyone either, and I'm not looking at her right now. But I think that, again, hair is such a fun way to think of it as architecture for me. So I really think of hair as sculpture.
My hairdresser, called Vinny.
Hi, Vinny.
No, not high-end. Vinny called and said, are you inspired by art?
Oh, 100%. When I pull inspiration, I actually don't go and pull, you know, the Grace Kelly or the Rita Hayworth. I actually go and pull photos from tribes in Africa, or I go and look at old Renaissance paintings, or I go and look at architecture. Mm-hmm. Then I reimagine it. And the truth is that women really inspire me. The woman that sits in my chair is my first and true inspiration.
And you have next to you a woman in the chair who's Karen Miller-Medson, our producer.
Yes.
Who, Karen, discussed your hair on many occasions. I think it's a wonderful curl. You've referred to it as a frizz. How would you describe your hair?
It's a little wild and it's a little frizzy and it's the butt of many a joke on my running team. And
this is really combination hair. So when you really lift the top of her hair, her curls are a lot more defined. They're not as frizzy. You know, she colors her hair. She covers it. You know, she covers the gray. And so, you know, so there's a lot of texture when hair changes and becomes gray. And so a really easy way for her to really fix the textural problem is really just get a curling iron. But all she would need to do is take a big section,
which you are,
right at the top. I would not even touch the bottom of her hair,
which is gorgeous.
And I would just curl it on the outside. I wouldn't even put it inside the curling iron. I would take it out and then just tug on it.
Look at
so
that.
All of a sudden, you have these beautiful curls. All of a sudden, you have great texture.
So while you're doing that there, I want to talk a little bit about you. Superstar to the stars, star of the red carpet. You come from a family that immigrated from Morocco to Israel?
To Israel, yes, correct.
Where you lived in an impoverished area.
Correct.
And were sort of outcasts.
Correct.
Yeah. And your dad started what was kind of the Black Power movement in Israel.
He started the Black Panther movement in Israel in the late 70s and it was really about a cry for equality, and he really fought for human rights for a lot of people who did not have a voice when they moved. And so I grew up around a house that was really about connecting with humans on a very deep level, and my mom was a painter. And it's funny, my dad came back like a few years ago and brought all of my old drawings, and all of my drawings were of women and their hair. And it's just, it's incredible how hair found me in the process of my life.
Why do you think that is?
Hair is really about practicing. Hair is something that is constantly growing. So you should experience and you should take risks with it. You know, we're very scared to try different things and to express ourselves.
Yeah. We've got Mary sitting next to you. She's got straight, stick straight hair.
So first, I think it's about putting a little bit of texture. Yeah. Living Proof makes a great, like, dry shampoo.
I have Living Proof in my hair right now, but it's not the dry shampoo. It's the 5-in-1.
Oh, great.
I use the dry shampoo.
Which is great. The dry shampoo is great because it really cleans your hair, but it creates good
texture. I have the Bumble and Bumble Preta powder in my purse.
Which I love.
Yeah.
You're saying this as you're giving Mary just a little bit of volume with the curling iron.
Correct.
Just shaking out some curls.
So I'm just taking big sections and I'm just curling her hair just so when I throw it up, I have some texture.
Okay. Some updos, they gather at the back of the nape of the neck.
Yes.
But how do you get an updo up?
So I will tell you my theory behind hair.
Yeah.
I truly believe hair is like architecture. If you don't create the right foundation, everything else collapses. So it's creating a right foundation that has memory right at the roots, then creating your shape that you're looking for. So now that we have done that, do we have, yes, we have a comb.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to just tease it and create a little bit of texture right at the roots, creating the right foundation. And if you have the right foundation, everything else is going to hold up.
So you're pinning this up with the curly side of the bobby pin, and I noticed you pulled one side over and up. You're doing the top up first.
Yes, so I'm creating a little bit of height right at the crown, because what girl doesn't look good with like a little Brigitte Bardot?
Right. When you are doing that's something that's more architecture.
Yes.
Do you is there some sort of model that you do it on first?
No. So I get to work a lot of these things in my brain in my sleep. So before big events, I'm almost like a builder and a construction worker in my brain. So I think about the architecture and what products I'm going to use and what curling iron I'm going to use to actually lift it and build it and do all of that.
Yeah.
So
you've worked it out.
I've worked it out.
Adir.
Yes.
Do you ever find yourself thinking, wait a second, my father, mother, immigrants considered, you know, maybe of a lower class when they got to Israel. You were actually sent to a family in the U.S. when you were eight to be raised here.
Yes.
And now on the covers of magazines. And do you ever say to yourself, how did this happen?
I guess in all honesty, I don't think about the process. All I know for me is that I've been very present in my life. It's just been a beautiful process to just engage with human beings and give them confidence and make them feel beautiful. And in the process, when you work hard and you give all that you've got, sometimes it works out.
Yeah, big time.
And I do realize, and I am very conscious of how blessed I am that for me it worked out, because there's people who work a lot harder than me and give it their all, and it doesn't.
Yeah. Biggest thing that you think women overall not doing wrong with their hair, but what you would say might be a mistake?
I think worrying too much about what everyone else thinks.
Adir Abergel, hairdresser, and a lot more.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me here. I feel really lucky to be here today.
Okay, for pictures, for some wonderful reason, our colleague Mary is wearing a gown. And for a video where you can see how he begins pinning up pieces from the top of her head first, then works his way down. You don't just pull the whole thing up from the bottom like someone we know. It's all at hereandnow.org.
Israel deployed hundreds of additional troops to the West Bank today and has imposed sweeping restrictions on Palestinian travel after two Palestinian gunmen opened fire yesterday in a crowded Tel Aviv market. The attack killed four Israelis. Overnight, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended Israel's response.
We're going to take the necessary steps to attack the attackers and to defend those who need to be defended.
The Palestinian president condemned the killings while the Islamist group Hamas praised them. Neri Zilber is a journalist and adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He joins us via Skype from Tel Aviv. Neri, welcome back.
Good to be with you again, Jeremy.
And give us a little more detail about what we know at this point about the attack and the attackers.
Well, the attack took place yesterday evening in a crowded restaurant and shopping complex in central Tel Aviv. Two terrorists from the southern West Bank, relatives in their early 20s, came in dressed in suits and ties and opened fire in a crowded cafe at fellow customers.
Neri, one of the things that we saw yesterday as this story was breaking was the video of the police, the authorities, responding very quickly and out in public to this attack. How quickly are they able to respond to things like this? Do restaurants like the one where the attack took place have their own security?
That's a great question. So the interesting thing about this complex is that the security is actually quite lax relative to other big shopping centers. It's an open-air development, and you don't quite have the same security presence at the entrance to the development as you had as you have in other places. But having said that, it is in the heart of Tel Aviv. You have the Israeli military headquarters across the street, and from all reports, security guards at an adjacent building actually were the first responders.
Is there a reason that this would happen right now? Is there something that would trigger a new wave of violence? Because it does seem like it's been a while since there's been even a smaller attack in Israel.
I think that's correct. We've seen over the past 8 months, obviously, a wave of violence and terror, but that actually has waned in the past 2 or 3 months. So the attacks, while seemingly coming every day, have actually abated for the most part. So this actually came as a shock to the Israeli public, and I think it's important to also mention that it came on the third night of Ramadan,
right?
The Muslim holy month. So Ramadan historically has been a period of heightened tensions, and especially this year was expected, coming at the end of this wave of violence, to be tense.
And the fact that it is Ramadan is also important for the Israeli response. They have just restricted travel for many Palestinians.
That's correct. Almost every year, the Israeli authorities issue travel permits for West Bank Palestinians, numbering in the tens of thousands, to enter Israel, to visit family, to go to the beach, to go shopping. That was instituted a few days ago, and this morning was rescinded in the wake of the terrorist attack. So that's the major Israeli response as of now to yesterday's attack.
And is that just going to exacerbate the situation? I'm just wondering, do people in Israel feel that it's necessary to restrict travel because of this attack?
Well, I think there's two things to keep in mind. Number one, this is what the Israeli authorities would describe as a goodwill gesture towards the Palestinian population. It's important to keep in mind that almost 100,000 Palestinians in the West Bank work in Israel. And those work permits have actually remained in place, which wasn't a given coming out of last night. So relative restraint by the Israeli government has been exhibited on that end.
So what happens now? When will these restrictions be lifted, or is there any sign that they will be at some point?
It's a good question. I think the response by the Israeli government today in the wake of the attack was measured in the sense that they didn't want to exacerbate the security situation in the West Bank, but they're also playing to the Israeli public. Obviously, a new defense minister took up his post not even 2 weeks ago. He's an ultranationalist, made very hardline statements before taking up the post. And as of now, though, he's showing relative restraint.
What does it feel like today in Tel Aviv? How are people feeling after this attack?
Honestly, it's back to business as usual. The development, the market that the attack took place in yesterday was reportedly full of customers, as well as journalists and politicians. The actual cafe where the shooting took place was repaired and is back and open for business this morning. Life goes on in Israel. Unfortunately, it's not the first terrorist attack, and tragically, likely won't be the last.
That's Neri Zilber, a journalist and adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, joining us from Tel Aviv. Neri, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.